So you find this kind of parallelism and then inverse parallelism going on throughout both of these books. In other words, they're working together.
The one book that I think has caused more fear and anxiety for people was actually written to bring comfort. When you sit down with John and say, hey, John, what's up with Revelation? He goes, in the midst of your suffering, it should have brought you encouragement. He's like, no way, man. People's heads getting cut off of dragons. And like, I was afraid I was going to miss the rapture. He's like, miss the what? Welcome back to another episode of Kingdoms Unveiled. And we are tackling things like the book of Revelation from a supernatural perspective. You got two pastors who are not afraid to talk about things like the gods, the divine council, the Nephilim. These are subjects that we often avoid and we put in the fringe part of our faith. Or the section, Doug, or I love to hear this, why does it really matter? Why do you want to talk about this stuff? Nobody cares. And we're here to say it does matter and you should care. And this is the whole point of the podcast, to talk about the veiled parts of our faith, the kingdom of light and the kingdom of darkness. Your hosts are Doug Van Dorn, pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Boulder, Colorado. And I'm John Moffitt. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. If you'd like to learn more about Doug, you can go to douglasvandorn.com, learn more about him. And believe it or not, I have a website. And yay, you go to John Moffitt. Hey, you go to johnmoffitt.com.
Is this a new thing?
I've had it for years. It's been dormant, and I just kicked it back up because there are things that I want to write about that I have nowhere to put them. So I'm going to start putting them over there.
There you go.
Articles about, stuff like the gods and even articles thinking through things like dating and children and marriage. So all kinds of stuff. Doug's, all of his sermons and podcasts, he's been on a lot of them, are at his website. I kept my website. I didn't let it falter. Therefore, I'm better than you because mine is johnmoffitt.com.
Don't remind me of the good old days when it was
just
Van Dorn.
Just put a little reminder on that if it ever comes available again. Okay, so a couple of weeks now, we've been going through a series on Revelation. If you haven't gone back, I would start at the episode we did about 4 or 5 weeks ago. We were talking about the binding of Satan and really just kind of thinking through the idea of what's going on in Revelation. Last week, we introduced to you really the structure, like how do you read Revelation so that when you read it, you're really understanding the point. And today, which we talked about, we blew it up real big. What is the point? Like, why are we reading Revelation? What is it telling us? And what should we be taking away from it? And our argument is going to be, it's a little bit different from our dispensational rapture perspective of the text, but instead of kind of telling you up front, we're just going to walk you through the structure of it. So Doug, let's kind of pick up where we left off last week. We argued that this was more cyclical in nature, that you're looking at one event, which we're going to talk about here in a minute, from seven different vantage points, basically was what we're arguing. And so we're going to pick that conversation back up and add some more tools to your toolbox so that at the end of this particular podcast, you should have enough of an introductory to go back and read the book and understand in general what it is that you're looking at.
So I think I brought up a word last time. I don't remember, but I think I did. The word chiasm.
Yep. You alluded to it, but we didn't explain it. Yep.
Yeah. And so that's really what we're going to look at here today. And many people are not familiar with what this is. And so let's just talk about what a chiasm is, first of all. Mm-hmm. You can have a chiasm that works on the level of a sentence. Mm-hmm. So Jesus will say something like, the first will be last and the last will be first. And so you have an A, B, B, A there. So The first begins it and then it ends it. And then last is in the middle, in two places. So first becomes A and last becomes B. So A, B, B, A. The first will be last, the last will be first. If I was to add a name in there and I was to say the first will be last, John, and the last will be first, then John becomes the focus,
right,
as opposed to last being the focus. So it becomes an A, B, C, B, A. And this is a very, very common way of talking. Ask not what you can do for Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
For your country.
Right? So John F. Kennedy was using a chiasm when he said that. It becomes very memorable and pithy and when you do it on a short level. Well, you can do this on the level of a paragraph. You can do so. You might have five sentences or something that are doing it. You can do this on the level of a chapter. You can do this on the level of an entire book. And you can do it on the level of a whole series of books if you want to. And I said last time that you remember Revelation ends kind of in the Garden of Eden. Well, so you can look at the whole Bible as a giant chiasm, an A-B-A chiasm. The A is you're in the garden, and then B is everything up from, you know, Genesis 4 until Revelation 19, and then you're back in the garden. And it's a way of, it's a form of a ring composition where you're ending where you're beginning that we talked about last time. So how in the world might this idea matter to the book of Revelation? And this is where it starts getting pretty crazy. Now, in the book, I gave an analogy.
You know what? I'm sorry, Doug. We did not talk about that. So this is in reference to a book that Doug wrote about 6 months ago. So give them the title and where they can get it from, just because I completely forgot to do that.
So there's two books. There's The Rings of Revelation, and it's gold and black. And then there's The Rings of Revelation, the companion study guide, and it's silver. And so those are two different books. They're not the same book. One is the actual kind of short commentary and how to read the book. And then the other one is like all these charts and graphs and Old Testament allusions in Revelation and outlines. And so all this material that I've kind of gathered over the last 25 years of preaching this through this book. In that book, I begin it really with an analogy that my friend Michael Amati, who's a missionary out in Ireland, one of our Reformed Baptist missionaries, he told me about this crazy ring theory, ring composition in Star Wars. And so if anybody would like to hear that, we did that for my Giant Steps podcast. It's episode 6. And I had Michael come on and kind of go through the whole thing. So you can hear that over on YouTube or Apple or wherever. And it will be, first of all, you'll never watch Star Wars the same way again.
No, nope.
Like there's no way that this could possibly be what's going on. But George Lucas actually managed to turn Star Wars into a 6-movie chiasm, which is mind blowing, and it works on a whole bunch of different levels. But that's for another time. And I just use that as another analogy for how to understand these.
You got to buy the book in order to hear about the chiasm, is what you're saying?
Or go to the podcast.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so how does this matter in Revelation? So as I first started preaching through this 5 years ago or so, I came across a scholar who taught at Reformed Theological Seminary, I think in Orlando at the time. His name is Warren Gage. And he did his dissertation on John and Revelation and their connections to each other. So the Gospel of John, in my opinion, has the final hand of the same person who wrote Revelation. So the same guy is involved in how they're both being formed and written. And I believe it's the Apostle John who has that final say in how that those books came about. So one guy, two books. Just same way Luke and Acts actually are one guy in two books. And in fact,
or while Luke, I'm thinking about Hebrew. That,
what's that?
Yeah. Luke, Acts, and Hebrews.
Well, Luke and Acts are actually written to be a pair. And Luke tells you this at the beginning of both books, right?
Right.
And in fact, there's a chiasm that goes between Luke and Acts that can help people understand a chiasm in a different way. So Luke begins in the Gentile world of the Caesar. And then he focuses in when he starts Jesus's ministry in Galilee. So this is actually a geographical chiasm. After he's in Galilee, so in Luke's gospel, Jesus isn't going back and forth to Jerusalem like he does in John. He stays in Galilee the whole time.
Right.
After he leaves Galilee, he goes down to Samaria in Judea. And then after that, he goes to Jerusalem, where he is crucified and ascends into heaven. That's how Luke ends. Acts begins with the ascension, and then it focuses in on Jerusalem And in really the thesis statement of the gospel of the book of Acts, he says, you will go from Jerusalem to Judea to the in Samaria to the ends of the world. Well, that's how he frames Acts. So now you're in, starting in Jerusalem, you go out to Samaria and Judea, and then you go out to the ends of the world, and you end up in this very same place that the Gospel of Luke began, in the realm of the Caesars, where Paul right. Is now sitting in Rome awaiting his trial. So it's a literary way of framing a book. And John mm-hmm. is doing this in an insane way, dude, in the book of Revelation. So, and the reason why I think that this is especially fitting for our podcast, we could, mm-hmm. you could do this on Theocast without the same kind of emphasis,
right?
But it's especially fitting for us because all chiasms have a center. They have a beginning mm-hmm. and then they have a center. And what it turns out is,
for someone who maybe never seen one, visually.
Visually, it looks kind of like an arrow if exactly. you put it sideways. So yep. you think about an arrow where it's got the two ends mm-hmm. and then it goes to a point. That point becomes the center of your structure and really yep. the main point that you're trying to make. So in other words, when we're writing a composition for eighth grade English class or something, mm-hmm. we're kind of told to put our main point in the thesis at the beginning of the book.
Yep.
This isn't really the way a chiasm works. Its main point is at the center of the thing.
Right. At the point of it.
At the point of it. If you turn that arrow 90 degrees rotated up, you have a mountain. You mm-hmm. can think of it as a mountain. And so the top of the mountain would become this central point.
And to be fair, Doug, this is very popular in like in the Psalms.
Dude, right. it's everywhere. I'm convinced that this is the way that ancient minds thought. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why is because it reduces the amount of information you have to learn by half. Mm-hmm. Because you get to repeat everything that you just said. And in an oral culture where you have to memorize stories, why yep. wouldn't you do? Why wouldn't you make things easier for yourself, right?
Right.
We don't have to right. memorize anything anymore. And no. so we don't no. think like this.
No, I was even thinking about the other day. Someone was giving me like verbal direction somewhere. I was like, dude, just give me the address. I don't want to remember. I don't remember everything you just told me to do.
I can still remember my phone number growing up.
Wow.
466-4768. But I couldn't tell you what my phone number is now. I've had it for like 15 years.
That's funny. Yeah, it's because you had to remember back then.
You had right, to remember.
So, You gave a key here that I want to go back to. So when we write, we put our thesis statement up front. Like this is what you need to know, and now I'm going to explain it.
Right.
You're saying in a chiasm in ancient writings, you have explanation to a point. So you got A, B, C at that point of C, and it goes C backwards to B, A. That center point, that focal point, that's really like the most important.
It's a pivot.
It's a pivot.
So you yeah. can think of it like a door that mm-hmm. becomes the hinge of the door. And okay. so that's the hinge upon which everything else in your book is turning or revolving around.
Working around. Okay. Yep. Cool.
Okay.
All right. I just wanted to give somebody like yep. a recap good. Visual before we go forward.
That's good. So it turns out in Dr. Gage's study, and you can go to his, I think he has a website where you can actually download a couple of PDFs that will show you what we're going to talk about a little bit later after we go through this one. But if you want to see this visualize what I'm about to show you, you can go to my website, douglasvandoren.com, and you can go to the book of Revelation where I have that kind of up there for you to see. And at the very top of that, I'm just giving this PDF away for free. It's a visualization that he never put into visual form, but which I took and color coded it so that it makes it easy to see what we're going to look at here. Mm-hmm. So, verse 9 of chapter 12 and verse 10 of chapter 12 become the pivot of the book. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to just hold up a book of Revelation in your hand and you were to open it to the center, you'd probably come right about to that if you just opened right. it up, right? Just like right. Psalms is the center of the Bible, right? This is the center of Revelation. So, on just that kind of an idea, it makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And this is what it says. And the great dragon was thrown down. So
this
down.
Is, just to be clear, this is Revelation 12:9. Okay.
The great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who was called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world, who was thrown down into the earth. and his angels were thrown down with him. Now, we looked at that last week, and I said we come back to it this week. Last week, we were looking at it as it shows up in conjunction with chapter 20. So we were talking about rings and cycles of the book and how there's probably about seven cycles of the book that keep repeating. But it's not the only way you can look at this book. You can also look at it as a giant chiasm. So now we'll take chapter 20 off the table. We'll just look at chapter 12. And what we're going to see here is that Revelation 12, 9 that I just read pairs up with the next verse. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. So there are several things that are parallel in these two verses. You have a fourfold title of Satan. He's called the dragon, the serpent, the devil, and Satan. And you have a fourfold title, a fourfold way of talking about Jesus's authority. Salvation, power, kingdom, and authority of God and Christ. So those are put on, those are contrasting each other at the center. They become the tip. So Satan on one, Jesus on the other. Fourfold Satan, fourfold Jesus. And you also notice that in verse 9, Satan is thrown down who deceives the world. And you find in verse 10 that the accuser is thrown down. Okay. So it's repeating itself. This is your hinge. Now, here's where it gets crazy. If you go back one verse to verse 8, 12:8, you find that the devils did not prevail over Jesus and the saints. If you go one verse after verse 10, you find that the martyrs overcame them. So the devils are not prevailing and the martyrs are overcoming them. Just one verse on either side. They're paralleling each other again.
Wow.
Now, if you go back just one more verse to verse 7, you find that there's a war in heaven and there's a dragon. If you go just one verse forward from verse 11 to verses 12 and 13, you find that heaven is rejoicing because the dragon has been thrown down to earth.
Look at that. That's awesome.
Okay, if you go back one more verse, you find that the woman flees into the wilderness and there's a place prepared by God. And she's nourished there for a time. If you go just one more verse forward, you find verse 15, you find a woman is giving birth to the male child. And you're going back again, one more verse, the dragon's tail sweeps a third of the earth. He stands before the woman to devour. If you go to verses 15 and 16, the serpent's mouth sweeps away and helps and the earth helps the woman. You go back again, behold, the dragon with seven heads and 10 horns and seven diadems. You go back to, you go forward one verse. Now you're in chapter 13. There's a beast with 10 horns, seven heads, and 10 diadems.
So it's now hard to see the connection, is your point.
So I came across somebody on Facebook. Somebody said, what do you think about Van Dorn's chiasm of Revelation? Well, first of all, it's not my chiasm. This was a doctrinal dissertation done by Dr. Warren Gage. Second of all, the guy goes, oh, he's just making stuff up. Okay, I challenge you to go and look at this chiasm and look at every single one of these pairs. And John, here's what's really crazy about it. These pairs don't skip any more than a verse or two, and they go all the way back to chapter 1 and all the way out to chapter 22.
Well, and to be frank, or to make a point, the letter, the numbering is not inspired. That was added later.
Exactly.
So you're talking about more comparing sentence and paragraphs, really, is what you're talking about.
You're comparing sentences and you're looking at exact words. So if you go to chapter 1, verse 1, you find that these things must happen quickly. If you go to chapter 22, verse 20, so almost the end of the book, it says, I'm coming quickly.
That's pretty obvious.
If you go to 1 verse 3, you say, hear the words of this prophecy. If you go back just a couple of verses in chapter 22, 18, it says, hear the words of the prophecy.
Wow.
If you go to 1 verse 8, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. If you go to chapter 22, verse 13, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. John, this goes all the way. It's something like, I don't know, 65 or 70 levels deep.
Wow. So you talk about planning out what you're going to write ahead of time.
Right. Good. So this isn't an A, B, C, B, A. This is an A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, N, O, B, Q, R, C, U, V, W, X, Y, Z. And then you have to start over. A, A, B, 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 C, C, D, D, E, E, F, F. And it goes all the way to Y, Y.
No.
And then it goes all the way back out.
To Y, Y.
To Y, Y. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, it's like 65 levels that this does this.
That's crazy. So has there ever been any, this is told like nerdy side road, but is there like ever been any research on like, did the, like John had to plot this out, or, you know, you see what I'm saying? It's like, how do you structure that? How do you think that way?
Okay. So I've thought about this question and I think it's probably possible from a human point of view, although insanely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to remember that as John's telling the story, okay, so on one level, you can read it straight through like a book.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes sense to read it that way. In other words, everything's kind of different. And yet you still have this pattern repeating. But right. It's not just that. It's also seven cycles are repeating.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you're reading this one large chiasm, in between, you have seven cycles, with the fourth cycle being the center of what we're talking about here, which makes sense because you have in a seven cycle, you have an A, B, C, D. C, B, A takes you seven, which means that the fourth cycle would be the center. And guess what the fourth cycle is? It's Revelation 12.
Interesting. So as you're talking, Doug, I think we Americans and English reading people at times, we don't like the fact, like when people, this is what I'm going to hear. I guarantee you we're going to hear this. This sounds too complicated. It sounds like you guys are just complicating things. Like we should just, you know, the Bible is at a fifth grade reading level. This is what we're always told.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, the English like grammar structure might be at a fifth grade reading level, but the comprehension of that is, that's just not like, and we're also just assuming we read it and therefore we understand it. And what you're saying is, Revelation probably takes about three readings to get the, like, because you have to do the first reading to realize the genre that you're in. Is that fair? Like,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then once you get to the end, you read the last verse and you go, wait a minute, that sounds exactly like that last paragraph sounds like the first paragraph. So then you read it through a second time, realizing, oh, he's connecting, because you don't know. There's no way you're going to know he's making a chiasm till the end. Is that fair?
Yeah, totally fair. I want to comment on
the second time. So the second time through, you realize there's a chiasm, and then finally that third time through, you're realizing, oh, it's a chiasm at the focal point is the middle, chapter 12, 9, and 10. And that's the point. That's the story that he's been cycling through over the last. So basically the third time through. And here's my argument, Doug, is that this is actually how the Bible works. Like, you don't really understand what's going on in the first five books of the Old Testament. Like, you can't just read Genesis and just think you're going to understand everything that's going on in Genesis. Man, you got to get to the New Testament at times to understand that he's even talking about a virgin birth in chapter 3. He's literally talking about a virgin birth, but you're not going to really understand that till Jesus is born of a virgin. And you're like, oh my gosh, that promise to Eve, that was totally a virgin birth prophecy. So the argument is that, yeah, at times you have to read the whole book and then read it backwards and backwards and forwards to get the full meaning. The first read through, you're probably not going to get the whole thing at first. So that was my argument, helping people understand that the whole Bible actually works this way.
And two things about this. So have you ever read Calvin and Hobbes?
No. Yes. Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yes.
So it was one of the saddest days of my life when he stopped writing that cartoon.
Right, the cartoon, yeah.
It's the greatest comic strip that's ever been written, bar none. Not even close. The Far Side comes close, but Calvin and Hobbes is genius.
Far Side is hilarious.
Here's the thing about Calvin and Hobbes. 4-year-olds love Calvin and Hobbes.
Right.
And 90-year-olds love Calvin and Hobbes. Why? Because you can read Calvin and Hobbes on two totally different levels.
Mm-hmm.
Calvin is a little kid who has a pet tiger, mm-hmm. and he acts like a little kid. But Calvin ain't no little kid, man. Calvin's like a stinking adult mind. who is a genius in the things that he says and does, because he's representing an adult, even though he's a kid.
Right.
Calvin and Hobbes works on multiple levels. Mm-hmm. Now take this to the Bible. You can talk about, and this will become even more crazy when we look at the next part of this. You can talk about the human author and how could the human author write this? But John, God is the author of Revelation.
That's right.
And God is not just a simplistic mind. He doesn't just have a simplistic mind. Yes. And our confessions work on this at both levels too, because everything that we need in the gospel is there for a child to understand. But you know what? It also talks about things that are not as clear as other things.
That's right.
Because the Bible is both something that a little kid can wade in a kiddie pool and not drown. And it's something that you cannot possibly ever fathom the deepest parts of the Bible. No human being could, because it's coming from an infinite mind.
Right.
So this is not an either or. This is a both and.
Right. Right. So a couple of recaps, and then we've kind of been hiding the lead. We're at 25 minutes in, so we can't hide the lead here anymore. So just so people are like, you guys are complicating it. Well, I think Doug proved to you that there is a connection. There's a correlation. The chiasm is not something someone forced into the text. And the reason why I mentioned Psalms is that it's all over the Psalms. You just type in chiasm Psalms, and I guarantee you
everywhere.
Yeah. I remember learning about this when I was learning Hebrew. And it's beautiful because you learn how a psalm will start and kind of lead you to its point. And then once you learn what the point is and you work your way back, then you go back and read the psalm, understanding what the point is. Like, it's designed to be repeated. Sometimes we think the Bible is like a one and done. Like, they didn't just read these letters once and they were done. They would read them over and over again. And because of that, that created the familiarity, which then they would understand, oh, hey, look, the point of this, which we're going to get to, is this. Now let's go back and read it again. And the more times you read it, and the more times that your mind is mulling over it, the more you're going to get out of it, which is, I mean, how true is that, Doug, of Scripture? The more times that you, over the years, have been studying this and preparing this, you get more and more richness from it, just because that's the design of it. Okay, so chiasm, point, chapter 12, verse 9 and 10. At that particular section, we're talking about the fall of Satan and the victory of Jesus. So what's the point, Doug? What's the point of the book?
Okay, so one more thing to say about the chiasm. If this thing is hinging in the middle of the book and then going back out, that's yet another sign that this thing is not necessarily meant to be read linearly. It's repeating itself the level of a chiasm, and it's obvious and deliberate. And that it doesn't end at the end of chapter 22, you know, it's ending at the middle of chapter 12 and then going back.
Right.
Now, you actually find these chiasms within the book all over the place, connecting various chapters. So there's chiasms within chiasms within chiasms, which just makes it pretty mind blowing. But what I want to do now is I want to take people to the other part of this, which is so crazy, which is the Gospel of John. Because Gage's dissertation was focused on John and Revelation. And what he started to notice is that Gospel of John begins the exact same way that Revelation begins. In John 1:1, John tells us about the Word of God. Well, in Revelation 1:2, John witnesses to the Word of God. In John 1:5, Jesus is the light that shines in the darkness. In Revelation 1:16, the face of Jesus shines like the sun. In John 1:14, we behold his glory as the only begotten of the Father. In Revelation 1:5-6, Jesus is the firstborn from the dead. To him be the glory. So this goes from chapter 1 and Revelation 1, John 1, Revelation 1, into chapter 2, into chapter 3, into chapter 4, into chapter 5. And you find that there are parallels that go all the way that parallel up John chapter 21 with Revelation chapter 22.
That's crazy.
Now, that's wild enough.
Right.
But it gets even crazier because it actually goes in the inverse. So that the end of John parallels with the beginning of Revelation. And then the next chapter, in Word with John, so chapter, 19, has parallels with Revelation chapter 2. And this goes all the way to the end of both books that way, so that the end of Revelation and the beginning of John also parallel each other. So you start thinking about that, and this is where my mind goes, this is not humanly possible to be written.
Right.
That's kind of what I was getting at. how could this be a thing?
Right.
And yet it's a total thing. Like, it's an actual real deal. And Gage has some videos that you can find online where he'll talk about these. I put up some of the charts in the book, but I didn't put the full content of it. But you can actually find the full content of that on my first sermon that I did in the Revelation series on our church website. And it's kind of an appendix at the end. Now, we don't have time to go into the details of that, but I do want to mention this. First of all, this makes sense of the fact that if Revelation 1 and Revelation 22 match up, and John 1 and Revelation 1 match up, then you could expect that John 1 and Revelation 22 would match up, because Revelation 1 and 22 match up. So you find this kind of parallelism and then inverse parallelism going on throughout both of these books. In other words, they're working together in some crazy wild ways. Now, here's where it gets the most wildest in my mind. The very center of John.
Just what I've been waiting for.
Is this. John hears a voice come from heaven, and the people who heard it said that it thundered, and others said an angel spoke. And then it says, now the ruler of this world, Satan, will be cast out.
And what chapter is this?
This is chapter 12 of John. Near the end of it. Verses 28 through 31. Now, we said that the center of Revelation was that Satan, who deceives the whole world, is cast to the earth, and his angels with him. And he hears a loud voice in heaven. And now salvation has come, and it's the exact same thing.
That's crazy.
So somehow, the casting out of Satan from earth to the earth in Revelation 12 parallels the ruler of this world being cast out in John chapter 12. Now, here's just an interpretive point. When does John say Satan is cast out? Now. The word is now.
Now is the judgment of the world.
Yeah. If it's paralleling Revelation, then you have a good reason to believe that Revelation 12 and the casting out of Satan is now. And when you read it in the context, that's exactly what it seems to be, because you have a boy being born and you have a war in heaven that seems to be happening simultaneous to it. And then the boy is taken up to heaven, and then you have this dragon and Jesus with all authority. And then you have the church being persecuted in parallel, in mirror to what happened earlier. So what does that mean? It means that the casting out of Satan in chapter 12 is the same casting out of Satan in John chapter 12. But now let's take it one step further, because chapter 12 of Revelation mirrors chapter 20 of Revelation, which means that the casting out of Satan in chapter 20 happens at the same time as the casting out of Satan in chapter 12 and the casting out of Satan in John chapter 12. In other words, the binding of Satan in Revelation 20 is a present reality when you read the literature the way that it is telling you it wants to be read.
Interesting. So this goes back to our episode we did on John 20. Revelation 20.
Yeah, so we're kind of bringing to a climax several episodes here with this connection with John's gospel to the book of Revelation. And to me, like, I don't know, you can ignore the literary features and just say, no, I'm not going to deal with them. But when you look at these, John, for the life of me, I don't see any other conclusion that you can come to.
Right.
This is how John wrote the books.
Well, and that's what I guess my argument, what I'm trying to say is, like, your first reading through is almost like okay, what's all here? You know, it's like when you do a puzzle, right? What do? You lay all the pieces out and you want to see what's everything that's there before you start making your conclusion. So your argument is that your first read through the book, all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, these are connecting. Chapters one and the beginning of Revelation, end of Revelation are connecting. And as you watch them connect, you get to the focal point, which is this war that had happened and the current victory and reigning that is happening is your point.
Exactly. Exactly. I wanted to give it some specifics on the inverse because I didn't do that. So here's an example. In John chapter 1, you have the Word of God and the old creation. Mm-hmm. In Revelation, the very end of Revelation, you have the Word of God and the new creation. It's very mm-hmm. explicit. In John chapter 2, you have a wedding in Cana. In Revelation 19, you have the wedding of the Lamb. In John chapter 3, you have Jesus talking to Nicodemus about coming out of the darkness. Well, in mm-hmm. Revelation 20 and 21, you have the city of light. In John chapter 4, you have the Samaritan woman. In Revelation 17, you have the whore of Babylon.
No way. It's all in your book, right?
The charts are in the companion volume. I didn't go into all this detail, but they're all in my sermons mm-hmm. that anybody can read those for free or listen to them. In John chapter 5, you have the old Jerusalem. In Revelation chapter 18, you have the great Babylon. So Jerusalem and Babylon are, and then, again, in the center, you have the accuser cast out of the earthly temple in John and the accuser cast out of the heavenly temple in Revelation.
That's crazy.
Now, here's where let's finally answer our question that we brought up last week that we would answer.
We made it 36 minutes.
What is it? Okay. So this is the suggestion of Gage, and I think that it works very well with the way Meredith Klein reads the book as mm-hmm. well.
For those who don't know, Meredith Klein is a reformed professor that has passed away.
Yeah, Gordon Conwell, he was out at Westminster Theological Seminary. Mm-hmm. And there's some other people too that when they notice these connections going on and the numbers, something is weird here. Okay. So there's a number that keeps repeating in Revelation. It's the number 42 months or the number 1290 days, I think it is, or 1260 mm-hmm. days. I don't remember which one. And the number 3.5, whether it's 3.5 years or 3.5 days. So here's the suggestion. And it's based on this idea that John has the accuser cast out of the earthly temple. Revelation has him cast out of the heavenly temple. Mm-hmm. And this, for the record, this is something that everybody has problems with in terms of a timeline. Everybody, dispensationalists, regular premillennialists. The question is, it deals with Daniel's 70 weeks. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Daniel has this prophecy of 70 weeks. And almost everybody agrees that at some point in Jesus's earthly ministry, those weeks are coming to an end. Mm-hmm. Now, people disagree about the last week. Dispensationalists think that that's future. I believe that the 70th week is cut in half so that you, in a week, in the way that you understand a week, it's 7 year periods of time. So there's 70 periods of 7 years each for 490 years. Mm-hmm. And that takes you back really to the decree of Cyrus or something like that to rebuild the temple. Starting at that moment, there will be 490 years until the abomination of desolation, which dispensationalists think is like a future antichrist in the temple, but which I read it and go, no, that's Jesus Christ becoming the abomination on the cross to forgive us of our sins.
That's right.
Okay. So at any rate, you have this number, which this last 70th week is the number 7. And when you divide 7.5, you get 3.5 and 3.5. Or you get 42 months or you get 1290 days or whatever. And the question is, what in the world does this mean in Revelation? Well, the suggestion that Gage gives, I think, is just genius. And to some degree, Meredith Klein, I think he wouldn't have a problem with this at all if he knew about this, but I don't think he did, is that the first 3.5 years of that week culminate in Jesus's death because his ministry is 3.5 years long. Mm-hmm. And it's a literal 3.5 year ministry. Physical earthly time. But when you read Revelation 12 and you see that, okay, after Jesus, after Satan's thrown down and Jesus is reigning, now we focus, now our mind is focused away from the boy to the church. Well, that's, Jesus gives us lots of analogies of how we're related to each other, right? A vine and branches, or a living temple made of many stones, of he's the cornerstone, or the husband and wife, or the main one is the head and the body. And so what happens to the head happens to the body. Mm-hmm. And so the 3.5 years in Revelation is this, it's a symbolic number that mirrors the earthly number of Jesus, because we're dealing here with heavenly time. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with however God is going to work out the timeline of his people on this earth. It's going to parallel Jesus's ministry on earth. And so what you have is, why would John 1:1 parallel Revelation 1:1 and going all the way through? It's because John's gospel is Jesus's earthly ministry given to you, laid out in a timeline. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What is Revelation? It's showing you that the same thing is going to happen to his people, because we are one. We are united together. And by the way, Luke and Acts are doing the exact same thing. I was telling you before the show that I'm preaching on Acts 12 this week. Mm-hmm. And it's Peter's third arrest, and he's arrested and he goes before Herod. Well, if you look at the arrests of Jesus, you find out he's arrested and he's taken, I think it's before, I forget the exact order, but he goes before Caiaphas, and then he goes before the Sanhedrin, and then he goes before Herod. Well, if you look at Peter, he has three arrests and it's the exact same thing. And you're like, what? Well, it's because as what happens to Jesus, so happens to his people. Acts is a record of the church in its history and how it mirrors what happens to Jesus in his ministry as the Gospel of Luke is being written. Same thing with John and Revelation. Revelation is the earthly period of the church's ministry in Jesus's place until he returns. And it mirrors it in all these crazy, wild ways what happened to Jesus. And of course, you know, you have the culmination of it in these wars and whatever, and the end of all things. But I think that that's the meaning. That's why this would happen. That's why John would write these things this way, because it's begging for us to read the gospel with the apocalypse.
Okay, so there is a spiritual. So as you're reading John, he's wrapping up both the past and the future, is what you're saying.
As he's writing the two volumes, that's what he's doing. John and Revelation should be understood in some ways as kind of like volume one and volume two.
Right. So when you're reading Revelation, what like in your mind from a time frame standpoint, where are you?
I don't know that a time frame is really what John has in mind. That's the whole point of why you write in cycles and circles and chiasms, because, you know, if there's a big persecution in the very earliest church and Jesus suffered a persecution, you're mirroring each other. If it's another persecution in the time of the Reformation, you're still mirroring each other. Like we even got into all the different ways of reading Revelation, like preterism and historicism and futurism, all this kind of stuff. People can disagree on that. My understanding is to kind of step back from the timelines of all that and let the literature itself work on you, so that if you're seeing something parallel, like in a wedding, two weddings, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, how am I supposed to think about this? Well, I'm supposed to think about it as Jesus culminates his baptismal week in John 1:1 that culminates in chapter 2 at the wedding of Cana, in the climax, which is ultimately speaking going to be this wedding supper of the Lamb that will happen at the end of time. That's what John is trying to show us there. It's and Jesus is foreshadowing it for us in his earthly ministry with his people that he's just called to himself.
Right. So let me pick up on something you said then. You were talking about the experience of Jesus. And so John's really describing that for us in his gospel. And in the apocalypse, John is connecting for us physical and spiritual, but it really is kind of mirroring like what's mystical. Going on in the other realm.
I would call it mystical, not spiritual, because when you say spiritual, people think that you don't mean literal. We've talked exactly. about this over and over on this podcast because the spiritual realm is a literal realm, but it's not the same realm as the physical realm.
That's right.
There's a, we talk about the mystical union that the church has with its Savior Jesus.
That's right.
What is that? Is it literal? Of course it's literal. Is it spiritual? Yep. Of course it's spiritual. Yeah. Mystical is, that's what it is. It's like, I don't understand how it is that my head is in heaven. And so therefore, in some real way, I'm in heaven, even though I'm sitting here on earth.
Right. Like if I were to say Jesus spiritually embodies me, that doesn't mean I don't mean it literally. I do mean it literally. Like his spirit is inside me, right? That's the spirit indwells me. And that's kind of, I guess when I've used this illustration in the past and so many use it now, is the book of Revelation almost like, I'm sure you've seen, did you ever watch Stranger Things?
Sure.
Right. So you have what you can see on the physical realm, and then there's the upside down. And when I read Revelation, it feels like John's talking to you and he's explaining to you both at the same time. He's like, here's what's going on from what you can see. And here's what's going on, what you can't see.
Yeah.
But it actually is going on. Like this, there was a dragon. It was in heaven. All this swooping was going on, and it's connecting to the events. And so when you read the book, the way in which I've understood and explained it, kind of to bring this all together, is you have Christians who are underneath an immense amount of suffering. They're proclaiming the gospel. John knows that they're going through this. He himself is going through this. So he writes the book to encourage them, because he says, blessed are everyone who reads this and believes, right? Like you're going to be encouraged by this. Because at the end of the story, what ends up happening? It's victory. We win. We walk into the new kingdoms, So the way we should read it is a culmination of past and present and what has happened and is happening in our experience. So as we're reading it, we should read it and get to the end and go, okay, where John's point is, there is a lot of nuts and crazy, and this is what has happened, and some of this is going, like, we do know that the end of the book of Revelation is to come. We're really excited about that. But that's the point of it, reading it, is it should bring encouragement. And as you're reading it, you are understanding that there is this mystical connection of what has happened in the past and what is happening right now. It's kind of the best way I'm trying to explain.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I think well said.
So you can read it saying, this is our current experience based upon what has happened. There is a past, present, and future aspect to the book of Revelation, but it's not meant to be read linear in this way.
Right.
In other words, it is mentioning the past. It is affecting us in our future, and it does point to, in our present, and it is pointing to our future. But you don't necessarily read it from beginning to end in that way. Is that a safe way of saying this is what's going on in Revelation?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And the reason why I'm mentioning it this way is that the book is designed to encourage you.
Exactly.
It's also designed to let you know, hey, this is nuts. Like, what's going on is gnarly. It's crazy. So if the world feels nuts and crazy, that's because it is. Mm-hmm. And I think as you read Revelation and you're hearing about the accuser and the dragon and this war and binding, I think that there are parts of that you should be taking literal. Like that has really happened, and this is happening, and the future is going to happen. And so I hopefully, as you think about it being a chiasm and the ultimate, the whole point of the book is the war between the kingdom of darkness, which is the point of this podcast, the kingdom of darkness and the kingdom of light, and the kingdom of light wins and the king wins. Like, that's the point of the book. So if I'm going to finally, like, at 48 minutes, the point of Revelation is that the king wins. That's the point. And that there was a battle. And he won on the cross, and he won in victoriously reigning, and the battle still rages, because mm-hmm. we're still as Peter says, don't count his patience, his holding back his wrath as something as he doesn't care. He's waiting for his kingdom to be fulfilled, which is to bring all of those in. So as you read Revelation, you should be reading it as the war between the realms. And do we win? You know, Peter writes 2 Peter chapter 3, because people are like, is he really coming back? He is coming back. John writes Revelation. Is Jesus really coming back? Does he win? Yes, he's winning now. And when he comes back, all things will be made new. So that's how you should read Revelation. Is that fair?
I think so. And that's the center of the book, which is kind of what we brought about, right? Satan has been cast down. It's a legal thing. The reason why we did Revelation 20 the way we did and talked about it so in depth is so people can understand that, yes, he can be bound and simultaneously roar like a lion together. That those are not mutually exclusive things. And so the devil is still here. He's still raging. He's still trying to destroy the woman in the wilderness. It's the end of chapter 12 is just like he tried to destroy the boy when he was born, when Herod tried to kill him.
Yeah. So it's beautiful. Like once you step back and read it with the proper tools in place and the structure and you understand what's going on, it's beautiful.
It's mind blowingly beautiful. Like this is incomprehensible how cool this is. And on one level, it's simple to kind of understand, and it kind of actually makes sense of some things when you're reading Revelation. How can that be there? Oh, it's because it's repeating or whatever. I can get that in my head. But at the same time, I could think about this for the rest of my life and not understand how this could possibly have been written.
Right. Yeah. Well, the one thing that I hope you walk away with, so get Doug's book if you want to dive into this more, both of them. And then if you want a kind of an introduction to some more of it, he did some more on his Giant Steps podcast. The point of it is that the one book that I think has caused more fear and anxiety for people was actually written to bring comfort.
Exactly.
When you sit down with John and say, hey, John, what's up with Revelation? He goes, well, in the midst of your suffering, it should have brought you encouragement. He's like, no way, man. People's heads getting cut off of dragons, and like I was afraid I was going to miss the rapture. He's like, miss the what? Little jab on my dispensational friends. I love you. Well, this is fun. And Doug and I've come from dispensational backgrounds. We used to believe it, embrace it. And so it's not that we don't understand it, and we're not mocking it because we think it's foolish. You know, there's a lot of good, smart, godly people who believe this and teach it. We're just offering another perspective that we think is grounded in its structure and grounded in its history. And if you disagree with us, man, we love you. And if you love Jesus and you're excited about Jesus coming back, hey, listen, we're on the same team. He's coming back and we're excited about it. So make your comments below based upon our love for Jesus. And we believe he's coming back. Make your comments below based on that.
Maybe that's in a strange way, a segue to the next episode.
Oh, which is?
Well, that people will have to tune in to find out.
Oh, hey, so this is Doug and I's last recording of 2024. And we record several weeks in advance. So happy new year to you guys. We're speaking to you from the past. I'm looking forward to 2025. Lord willing, we'll be back on the mics. And Lord willing, there'll be a new president. I'll just leave that there. We'll see you guys next week.